in the past year. And since this is a cosmology meeting, you're all probably perfectly aware of the history which led to the discovery of the CMB.
I thought maybe you're not so aware of the fact how the CMB was actually first predicted. At least I was not aware of that story until recently. And that I'll start with a short historical account on that, and that brings us back to the time when BBN was not used to probe any new physics, but rather known physics probed the Big Bang, if you wish. So in the mid-40s, especially Gamow, the spirit of the bottle, contemplated that maybe all chemical elements in the universe are made in the Big Bang. And he envisaged a scenario where you start out with a very dense gas of neutrons, hot enough so that you have frequent nuclear interactions. And he thought maybe that successive neutron capture reactions could build up all the elements in the universe. He soon realized that actually due to the high mass density which is required, the universe would be expanding rapidly, and this whole calculation would need to be essentially a non-equilibrium dynamical one. And then the first step for this was taken in this famous paper by Alpha, Beta, and Gamow in 48. Their work was actually facilitated by the fact that after World War II, data on thermonuclear neutron capture reactions became public, and so they wrote this famous paper, but they did not include the black body radiation. So soon after that paper, Alpha and Gamow independently realized that the universe is actually radiation dominated and that the CMB drives expansion. And Gamow came up with an estimate of the required baryon density. And then it was only a small step for Alpha and Hermann here to come up with a prediction of today's CMB temperature, and they had the value of 5 kV. Ever since, a lot of science has happened, and just to go quickly over that, so it soon became clear that this picture of a hot dense neutron gas is a wrong one, and one cannot produce all the elements, essentially because there are instability gaps of atomic mass number 5 and 8, and they prevent the fusion of heavier elements, and so that what one gets out of primordial nuclear synthesis is essentially helium and maybe traces of lithium. And by 53, more or less, all the basic physics was in place for describing BBN. And then, of course, in 55, the CMB was discovered. Now, arriving in the new millennium, cosmology became what we could call a precision error, so to speak. And now we have knowledge of the baryon density to better than 3% at a redshift of a few thousand. So at the time when matter radiation decoupled. Assuming then a field content of the standard model, putting that into a Friedmann-Robertson-Walker universe, allows one to take this number of the baryon to photon ratio and extrapolate it back to a redshift of a billion and use it as an input for primordial nuclear synthesis. And by that, what we call standard Big Bang nuclear synthesis becomes essentially a parameter-free theory. So let me quickly go over the picture here. So here on the x-axis, plotted is temperature, dropping from left to right, and up there is cosmic time increasing as one goes to the right. Starting off at very high temperatures, weak equilibrium keeps neutron and protons, weak interaction processes keep neutrons and protons in equilibrium. At some point, these freeze out, and so does the neutron to proton ratio. But then for a while, nothing happens because deuterium, here shown in red, which has a binding energy of 2 MeV or 2.2 MeV, cannot build up due to the overwhelming amount of photons. The plasma, and only once the temperature drops to 100 keV or so, deuterium can build up and gives way for the fusion of helium here. Then everything goes very quickly, and essentially all the neutrons become incorporated in a very short amount of time into helium, which leads to this strong drop here of the neutron abundance, and which explains the characteristic peak in deuterium. Other elements which are fused are helium and tritium here at the same level of deuterium. Tritium later beta decays into helium-3, and lithium-7 is actually produced in form of beryllium-7, and at a much later time, once beryllium receives its first electron, it captures it and converts itself into lithium-7. So the lithium abundance is produced in form of beryllium-7. Lithium-6, which is also a stable isotope, comes out in only very tiny abundances, which is somewhat of an accident. But and everything happens at a redshift of a billion, so it's natural sometimes to use units of 10 to the 9 Kelvin. Okay, so here are flashed the DDN predictions. As I said, helium here comes out highest with a mass fraction of around 25%. That translates into one helium atom per 12 hydrogen atoms. Deuterium and helium-3 come out at the level of 10 to the minus 5. Lithium-7, there has been an update on the reaction rate for this for this isotope. The prediction stands now at 5 times 10 to the minus 10, and lithium-6 is tiny. Now, of course, having the predictions here at the WMAP inferred baryon density, we should compare that with observations. And I just want to flash through two observations, that of deuterium and lithium. Okay, deuterium is observed can be observed in quasar absorption systems by the isotopic shift with respect to hydrogen. And it's important to note that there are no non-astrophysical sources of deuterium. So that means its evolution is extremely simple. It's monotonic, and once there is a detection of deuterium, it gives you a lower limit on its primordial abundance. However, these determinations are difficult, and only a few exist. And averaging those together, one gets this value here. What is maybe interesting to note is that there are also deuterium measurements in the local interstellar gas by the FEW satellite, for example, and they found an unexpected dispersion in deuterium, which is explained by potential deuterium estration on dust grains. So in principle, one might worry, can there also be systematic effects in the quasar absorption systems? And looking at the spread here, one can be conservative, and if one wants to use an upper limit on deuterium, one can just take the highest determination available, and this gives you this bound here of 4 times 10 to the minus 5. In contrast to deuterium, lithium cannot be observed in these high redshift absorption systems because it's just too tiny of a trace. Instead, one can look at stellar spectrum and look at the absorption lines there. And since metallicity traces age, and since lithium as well as beryllium and boron are producing cosmic rays, one seeks stars of very low metallicity, and one tries to find the primordial abundance there. And as is well known, doing that shows that lithium exhibits a plateau structure once one goes to very small metallicities here. And that plateau structure, which is called the speed plateau, that really points towards the primordial origin, the independence of metallicity. So at higher metallicity, there will be a rising trend because of the cosmic ray production. And all these determinations more or less lie in the range between 1 and 2.5 times 10 to the minus 10, whereas the standard DDN value now stands at 5 times 10 to the minus 10. And this factor of a few discrepancy here this is what is referred to as the cosmological lifting problem. Now, I thought you might be interested if I flash some recent results on the speed plateau. So last year, for example, marks the first detection of extragalactic lithium in stars of Omega Centauri. And there they rediscover the speed plateau on the level which is consistent with the galactic determination. So that's good news in principle.
And is that?
Oh, no, the galactic determination is not in here, but okay, so these are here these astrophysical units, but in principle it translates to a to lithium over age around the same value. And the VDM predicted value is up here, and so they quantify it as a 3 sigma discrepancy if you want.
But and so the underlying things, people think that a certain of this fraction, two-thirds of the lithium is not just destroyed in the first generation of stars. I mean, couldn't that be one explanation for it?
Yes, there is. I'll come back to that. To the, of course, people contemplate that, that there is an astrophysical solution to the lithium problem. But we will not pursue the astrophysical solution, but rather look for new physics interference. Okay, what is more puzzling are determinations of the lithium plateau at the very metal poor end of the speed plateau, so to speak. There are two publications which seem to indicate that there is actually some metallicity dependence of the stars, so some sort of a drop-off of stars from the speed plateau. Whereas others, for example, now find two plateau values. What to make out of these results is very difficult. I mean, the only thing I want to say here is, though these results might be puzzling, they do not per se alleviate the lithium problem. So they only make it worse because of, I mean, lithium drops even further from the deep plateau. Okay, just to summarize here now, I didn't show anything about helium, but in principle, there's a nice agreement. I mean, it will be very exciting to get better constraints here directly by measuring it from the measuring helium from the CMT. It'll be very exciting if the values are high. Deuterium seems to be fine for the moment. Helium-3 is somewhat difficult to assess because it's subject to strong galactic chemical evolution is produced and destroyed in stars. There's a long-standing discrepancy with lithium-7, and lithium-6 I will mention later on. So the question, of course, can we fix the lithium problem? And one line of attack would be to tinker with VDM. So let's do that. So what are the generic ways how we can attack the VDM predictions? Well, one very classical application is to change timing. For example, by adding extra relativistic degrees of freedom, speeding up the Hubble rate, affecting the neutron to proton freeze-out, and thereby affecting the other elements. Another way could be, say you have a heavy relic, which is metastable or long-lived enough that it would decay during BVN and dump energy, and thereby you would get short but strong deviations from local thermal equilibrium. And so, for example, you could split some helium and induce cascade nucleosynthesis processes here. More drastic modifications can be achieved, for example, by assuming that there is a charged heavy relic around in the BVM plasma. Then this heavy relic could actually capture light elements and thereby modify the nuclear rates and produce strong departures from standard BVM. So let's try, for example, to change the timing and see if we can do something good for lithium. If you do that, and if you speed up the Hubble rate, and so if we increase the radiation content in the early universe, it turns out that actually deuterium and helium-4 are most sensitive to such a modification. Lithium-7 indeed drops,
This is because beryllium 7 is produced with sub Hubble rate, so by speeding up the Hubble rate, it appears to have less lithium. But the strongest constraints comes actually from an overproduction of helium, and there is no way of reducing lithium 7 by a factor of a few. So that won't work. So let me tell you a mechanism which works. And that is if we inject neutrons right after the main stage of the nuclear synthesis reaction. And here's a cartoon showing what happens. So assume here this dashed line is our neutron source, however we get that. And assume this dashed line, this neutron source decays, it produces neutrons, so we get an elevated neutron content here from the standard Vivian value. What happens to these neutrons is that they would immediately be intercepted by protons, because protons are just the most abundant target here, so that one is always so that one always faces then high deuterium values and produce more deuterium. But there is still a small chance that some of these neutrons are actually captured by beryllium 7, and that would transform beryllium 7 into lithium 7, and that is seen here. So this magenta line here would be the standard beryllium 7 prediction. It captures the neutrons, turns itself into lithium 7, and lithium 7 is more susceptible to proton burning, so it will be destroyed by the protons and will be transferred back to helium. So lithium then gets destroyed, and you transfer it to helium. And what you end up is you end up with an overall lithium abundance which is decreased from the standard Vivian value. No? Not so well. Yes. Yes, but the point is the point is that lithium is produced in form of beryllium 7 plus lithium 7. So you have to take the sum, because at a later stage this one will go to lithium 7. It captures an electron and converts it itself into lithium. So you have to take the sum of both abundances. So what you do is you deplete. You destroy beryllium 7 in the first place, and then you destroy lithium 7. So here, it actually lithium 7, it goes up. I agree, it goes up from the standard model, from the standard Vivian prediction, but the sum goes down. So this scenario was actually quantified here in 2004 using the WMAP value of the baryonsymmetry, and Carsten showed that 10 to the minus 5 neutrons, so here 10 to the minus 5 neutrons per baryon are enough to achieve an order 1 reduction in the overall lithium abundance. Yep?
T of 0.5, you mean really right at T of 0.5, because if you did it earlier than that, they would thermalize, they would relax their thermal.
So what if you inject them too early, you don't have any beryllium around to induce this process, right? So if you go to earlier times, well, at some point you won't have any beryllium around. So you don't have an effect of that. You increase in the neutron abundance, and you will increase helium because the neutrons go into helium. So all you get is high helium values.
I'll actually
show more plots. You will see how the whole thing behaves.
But to get 10 to the minus 5 to actually make a big impact, or the unit in beryllium 7, even though beryllium 7 is down by 7 orders of magnitude from protons, meaning that the cross-section per interaction of beryllium 7 must be up by like 5 orders of magnitude or something.
Can you repeat that?
Okay, so you're adding neutrons, and only adding a small number of neutrons. You're going to add 10 to the minus 5
yes.
injection of neutrons. And you're going to make an order unity change onto beryllium.
Yes.
That's the idea. So that means that 1% of your neutrons are going to react with beryllium.
Yes, the neutron capture cross section is very high.
It's high.
It's 5 orders of magnitude higher than on protons.
I see. That's why it's got.
This is why you get an order 1 change in deuterium as well as an order change in beryllium, because they are 5 orders of magnitude.
Got it.
Separated from each other. Yes. Good point.
So another question is, where did we take the neutrons from? Force, you could make a simple assumption.
Let's take a heavy relic. On the electroweak scale, it decays with some hadronic branching fraction. It will produce hadronic jets. And here you have your neutrons. However, it turns out that one typically screws the other elements, so it's very hard to reconcile all element observations and solve the Lithium problem. So now we can ask the question, but what if X is light? And let's make it so light that it is below the dinucleon threshold. Then this particle X can only decay into leptons, pions, kaons, or hadronic resonance. And then we can get the neutrons out, for example, from we inject a negatively charged pion, the pion would charge exchange on the proton and produce a neutron. Or, say, if you're below the dipion threshold, we inject muons, the muons decay, and these anti-electron neutrinos can again undergo a charge-current interaction and produce neutrons. And such light sectors here, or such light particles, have received a fair share of attention recently because they can also mediate a fifth force here between the standard model and the dark matter and lead to enhanced annihilation. Such examples of a secluded sector, so a fifth force carrier, if you want, are, for example, a Higgs bottle model where you have you take a new singlet particle S and you couple it to the standard model Higgs via randomizable couplings, lambda and A here. Or you could also think about an additional U1, which has to be broken at some scale, so that you would have a new massive vector particle here, and also the Higgs prime, which is responsible for the breaking. And given, for example, these models, we ask, can we get a state here which lives long enough to do something to BDN? And let's consider for concreteness the vector portal here. This vector kinetically mixes with the photon, so it can decay into charged leptons here, and it typically has a very short lifetime. And the lifetime, of course, is governed by the link of the vector with the standard model. So that's the kinetic mixing parameter here. So if you want to have a long lifetime, what we can do is we can, of course, cut the link to the standard model and make kappa extremely small, 10 to minus 12. That would make this vector here what we can call a supervink, because it will be very feebly interacting with the standard model. On the other hand, if you want to have a sizable coupling here, we can go to a kinematic regime where this Higgs prime is lighter than the vector, then the Higgs prime can only decay either via two off-shell vectors into four leptons, or here via Lug-induced process. The bottom line here is, it's always possible to choose a long lifetime, and now we should also look at the actual balance. So here in this WIMP regime, where the H prime is a lighter particle, we might be worried that these particles are overabundant in the early universe, so we need to deplete them somehow. And it turns out that there is an endothermic reaction here, some sort of a co-annihilation process with leptons, which transfers H primes to vectors, which subsequently decay. And since there is an exponential mass, exponential dependence on this mass spacing between H prime and V, one can essentially dial through the whole abundance and always achieve the right parameters needed. The super-WIMP regime is somewhat more restricted, because then one really produces vectors out of a coalescence of, so inverse decays, a coalescence of two leptons, for example, going into a vector. Okay, this is just to show you that it's not hard to build a model for these sectors. Now let's see what happens to BDN if you do it. Okay, so take now a particle decaying into two pions. Then one immediately realizes what facilitates the treatment is that these pions, they will typically be stopped in the plasma before they decay. So the stopping power is very strong in the plasma, they will be thermalized, and then they decay because they only have a lifetime of 10 to minus 8 seconds. Some of them, however, really make it to the charge exchange reaction and convert protons into neutrons. And here's an estimate on that rate. and everything happens much faster than the scale of the expansion rate. Then we can simply estimate the efficiency of such a process. So let's take the proton interconversion rate, proton neutron interconversion rate, and integrate it over time, in which the pion really lives in the plasma. One finds that the efficiency per injected pion is order 10 to the minus 6. That tells us that if we manage to achieve an injection of 10 pions per baryon, we will get out 10 to the minus 5 neutrons, and that is what we want. And one can do a full numerical analysis, and that's what we find here. So here we plot the lifetime of this new particle versus its abundance. And these bands here are the bands where lithium really lies now in the in this range, in the observational range of the feed plateau. And this the dark shaded region here is then the region where we can reconcile all the other element abundances and solve the lithium problem. These dotted lines here show contours of constant deuterium. And as I've said before, one is always one always faces high deuterium values. So here we have, for example, 4 times 10 to the minus 5. Going to early times, one loses the early injection times, one loses the efficiency, and all what one has is actually high helium values here. So in principle, we can also explain a higher helium abundance if we wanted to. Going, on the other hand, going to longer lifetimes, these injected pions, they will just decay before they have a chance to interact with the protons, and so one loses the efficiency for long lifetimes here again. What is actually interesting here, there would be a region where we could solve the lithium problem and keep all the other elements at their standard BBN value. However, it seems like this region here is excluded by this dashed line. And that dashed line means the following. Pions not only get absorbed by protons or charge exchange on protons, but they also get absorbed by helium-4. And then you have the full pion mass available to split helium-4, and you would inject an energetic mass-free element like tritium. This tritium would then fly through the plasma, and it might hit another helium atom and produce some lithium-6. So we are actually faced with an overproduction of lithium-6 here.
The mass is sort of, it can lie anywhere between 2 GeV and 400 MeV or whatever.
Yes, so I... Sorry, here it's assumed that the pions are produced on threshold. In principle, you can have a more energetic injection of these pions. What happens is you actually have the chance to go by a delta resonance. So you would produce an excited nucleon which then decays into a neutron. And you can enhance this process and bring down these bands here by a factor of a few. I didn't put in a plot there. There's a lot of fun physics to play with. For example, you can have X decaying into kaons, then these kaons, they would have
strange quark exchange reactions with the nucleons, and they would produce hyperons. The hyperons decay.
Below the mass of the...
No, kaon
weights 490 something. And we were at the pion of them.
Yeah, so the paper is full of these scenarios. Just wanted to show this one. What I want to highlight here is that here we actually make contact with a non-equilibrium
scenario because we have now the pion mass available to produce an energetic mass-free element. And this is also a generic feature in all these non-equilibrium scenarios where you have a heavy relic, for example, decaying and injecting a lot of energy because you will produce nucleon showers which spall your helium, produce a mass-free element, and this energetic mass-free element might hit another helium and produce mass-6. And so lithium-6 production is a generic problem Of course, it's only a problem if there is indeed a primordial limit, an upper limit on its primordial abundance. So let's look at the observation. So back in 2006, there has been a claim, a tantalizing claim, that indeed there seems to be a second plateau in lithium 6 which mirrors the one from lithium 7 at an isotopic ratio of about 5%. And such a plateau would, of course, have very profound cosmological implications, because it would mean that lithium 6 is primordial with a value which is 1,000 times higher than predicted by standard DDN. However, the claim of the plateau has also been quickly challenged by Carell and collaborators, and they argue that since lithium 6 is not spectroscopically resolved from the line of lithium 7, one only infers lithium 6 from a slight asymmetry of the absorption line. So it could well be that this asymmetry is just mimicked by convective motion of the material. And that would mean that lithium detection go away, and indeed in 2010, these people here have reanalyzed the stars of the Aspen sample, and many of the detections indeed went away, especially those in the low metallicity region. So the upshot is that at least a primordial lithium 6 plateau is observational, its status is observationally doubtful. Moreover, let's assume now the following, that what if the lithium problem is really solved by some astrophysical mechanism? For example, it might be possible that lithium 7 is indeed destroyed uniformly by a factor of a few in stars. Then there is a danger that lithium 6 could have been depleted by a much larger factor, because lithium 6 is more fragile than lithium 7. And here I plot the stars of the Astman paper. They have given us here a particular stellar destruction model with some turbulent diffusion added, where they achieve a more or less uniform depletion of lithium 7. And along with the depletion of lithium 7, one can get very high depletion factors of lithium 6. And so that would mean that the upper limit on lithium, the primordial upper limit on lithium 6 is actually, might not be there, or might be considerably weaker. So the question is, can we find other observational handles on such non-equilibrium nucleosynthesis scenarios? Well, one possible path is the following. Now, let's go through this non-thermal cascade chain again here. We split helium, we produce mass equals 3. This mass equals 3 hits another helium, produces mass equals 6. Maybe this A equals 6 nucleus just has enough energy to hit another helium atom. Then we could produce beryllium 9. And it turns out that such a cascade is actually most efficient not by producing lithium 6, but by producing helium 6. And helium 6 has a lifetime of a little bit shorter than a second, so there is some chance that helium 6 hits another helium 4 and produces beryllium 9. Most importantly, this reaction here is exergic, so we are not punished by any negative Q value here. The question is, of course, can we then produce beryllium 9 in observable quantities? And just as a side remark, in standard DDN, beryllium 9 comes out of truly tiny values, really negligible, value of 10 to the minus 80. Well, for that we should, of course, look at observations. And here I plot some observations of these papers, and one can see there's a nice cosmic ray trend of these beryllium determinations with metallicity. The observations really go down to very small values, and one can use this upper limit here to infer an upper limit on the primordial abundance, which is 10 to the minus 14. So that's a very strong upper limit in principle. the good thing here is that beryllium is not subject to any stellar depletion, because beryllium 9 is less fragile than lithium 7 and more or less and way less fragile than lithium 6. So if you deplete lithium 7 by a factor of a few, nothing will happen to beryllium. And so this gives us potentially robust constraint. Okay, so how do we compute that? Clearly, this chain can be broken up into its pieces, and so given 1A+3 element, let's inject 1A+3 element, what is the probability to really produce beryllium? So that would be the probability from going of 3 to 6, averaged over some injection spectrum of the A+3 element, folded with the probability from going from 6 to 9, and finally there's a probability that that beryllium indeed survives. The good news here is that we can heavily rely on experimental data, so we can get a very accurate estimate actually of this process, and that's what we find for the conversion probability to beryllium 9. So as the temperature of the universe drops, the electrons, which are the These elements here are mostly stopped by Coulomb scattering on electrons, and the electron density drops exponentially at that time, and thereby we get an exponential rise of the conversion probability into beryllium, and that peaks at around the 20 keV or so, and then it will decline again, and at some point helium 6 starts to decay before interacting with another helium 4 atom. So all we need to do now is to take this conversion probability and to stick it into a Boltzmann equation. For that, we also need an estimate on the actual spallation rate of helium, so the spallation the rate of producing A+3. And long story short here, this is what we find. So here's a plot of abundance of a particle which weighs at TeV, and has a hadronic fraction, a branching fraction of 1. One can choose a different hadronic branching fraction. It would just scale here on the y-axis. And this is abundance times the hadronic injection energy.
Particle had mass above 2 GeV that it messed up other... I mean, this is the other abundance it messes up.
Yes, sorry. Maybe I didn't make this clear. So here we had very light X particles of the order of GeV or sub-GeV scale. And already there we got this issue with lithium 6 production. But this lithium 6 production is actually a generic issue. And it happens in all models where you have an electroweak scale relic decaying. And so here we take now a more general point of view and assume a heavy relic which decays, produces a nucleon shower, and eventually produces lithium 6 and beryllium 9. Yes, and so here's the final result. These dashed lines are contours of constant lithium 6, and depending on what value you choose for the upper limit, one can get a comparable constraint in beryllium 9. From its overproduction. And so we find that one can probe hadronic energy depositions down to 10 MeV per baryon, and as I've argued before, we think that beryllium 9 might be of good use as a robust constraint
in contrast with the lithium 6, for example. So to conclude, I tried to show you that BBN can now be used as a powerful tool to test and constrain new physics models, and essentially every model has to pass this cosmological consistency test. If one has a sub-GeV scale sector which decays at a few thousand seconds or so, one can actually resolve the lithium problem very generically, because the particle will always decay into pi or electrons or whatever. And one can do this via long-lived injected mesons like pi plus minus or k plus minus, k long, or via injecting neutrinos. I didn't show this scenario. And going again to the more massive relics, one can show that beryllium 9 acts as a calorimeter for these hadronic decays that may serve as a robust.
Any questions? One suggestion to solve the problem. Which you said is this inhomogeneous cosmological models, the local measured value, which you said is not the same as the redshift.